Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, June 15th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And joining us later will be Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. We'll speak to Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan, the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis of SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the stories from the Cape and the Islands. Cindy, there's a new bill under consideration at the federal level that would direct more money to conservation efforts around the endangered North Atlantic right whale. Tell us about this and about the groups involved.
It's called Save the Right Whales Act of 2018. It was filed in Congress June 7th. It would provide $5 million a year for conservation programs and technology that would prevent the ship strikes and entanglements that are killing the North Atlantic right whales and have reduced their numbers to, and it contributed to reducing their numbers to what's believed to be now only 450. So this is a highly endangered species.
This new bill is designed to bring together a number of different groups.
Yeah, fishermen and lobstermen. And so far, commercial fishermen's and lobstermen's groups are discussing this legislation, proposed legislation right now. And it was proposed by Congressman William Keating and Seth Moulton. And right now, they're involving the fishing industry and developing the what will be rules and regulations. IFAW has endorsed the SAVE Act. And this summer, they say that they'll be working with the U.S. and Canadian commercial fishing groups. And what they'll be doing is testing ropeless fishing technology. Mm-hmm. So that the whales won't get entangled. And the Cape Cod Times recently, our reporters Doug Fraser and Marianne Bragg wrote a beautiful but really sad story about what happens. It was a very in-depth look at what happens to these whales when they become entangled. And this is a slow and painful death for them. So it really made you understand what these whales experience when they have these encounters with the fishing gear. And so they're talked about other innovations, and they're saying, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. They can, you know, do something to prevent these needless deaths from occurring.
So this bill introduced by Keating and Seth Moulton, it would provide $5 million in annual money additional to what they're getting now to try to protect
yes.
these species.
Yeah, the National Marine Fisheries Service has been funding conservation programs to protect the North Atlantic right whale, and it's been more than $8 million annually since 2009, although there was a high of $12 million in 2005. So, and what's happening is, you know, there's no documented live births recently, and this is a huge issue for this population. The whales were seen in Cape Cod Bay this summer. You know, they usually they would calve in Florida, you know, come up through the Cape Cod area to feed, and now they apparently have gone on to the Gulf of St. Lawrence in Canada, where many whales have been spotted. And so far, there have been no, last year, starting in June, there were 12, you know, in this year's time, there were 12 whale deaths in the North Atlantic whale deaths.
From entanglement.
In the Gulf of, right. And then plus five down here in the U.S., plus five live entanglements down in the U.S. And what's happening, what's helping now, like, so the Canadian officials did respond to this kind of crisis situation. And what's helping are temporary closures of snow crab commercial fishing in the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And Canadian and U.S. officials are monitoring the shipping lanes by air. And they say, you know, so far so good. Although here in the U.S., you know, we've had the two whale deaths off Virginia, the two right whale deaths off Virginia recently.
And what's the word from fishing groups? Groups on this bill? Are they behind it?
They're interested in discussing it, and, you know, they want to protect their industry, but they're very interested in doing what they can to help protect the whales, and they want to be part of the discussion and part of the regulations that are coming up in the conservation programs.
Cindy, a Kitituat man has been found guilty in the stabbing murder of his wife. She was a special education teacher at Barnstable High School. Tell us about this.
Front Antonio was found guilty of first-degree murder for the stabbing, for the 2017 stabbing death of his wife Mary, also known as Molly. This was last Friday, and it took the Barnstable Superior Court jury just about 2 hours to deliberate, because he had confessed to this murder. This took place in February of last year.
Just a sad, tragic crime. It took place with the Fra Antonio's two children in the home.
Yes, yes. His 6-year-old daughter and 2-year-old son were in the house. As a matter of fact, after, and he admitted to police that multiple times that he'd stabbed her, and he actually sent a photo to a couple of friends of his wife's body. And in one of the photos, police said he'd cropped out for the friends, but there was a, you could see in the original photo, you could see his 2-year-old son by his wife's body.
So he is now, that's a first-degree murder. He goes to jail, to prison for, essentially for life.
Judge Gary Nickerson sentenced him to life imprisonment without parole, but all first-degree murder convictions in Massachusetts trigger an automatic appeals process to the state Supreme Judicial Court. But he'll be going to the Massachusetts Correctional Institution, Cedar Junction. That's the maximum security prison in Walpole.
And what did the family have to say around this?
Well, it was a very emotional, of course, a proceeding. And Mary Fratantonio's mother, you know, stood up to hear the reading, but she collapsed onto the bench sobbing. It was a horrible situation. And her brother, Mary Molly Fratantonio's brother, said that he called Christopher Fratantonio a savage psychopath. He said he let his own children see their mother's body torn apart with his hands. So this is a very, but the mother did embrace a prosecutor and a detective, thanking them for their work.
And Fratantonio's defense, in his defense, what did they say?
Well, the defense attorney said that the defense psychiatrist was said on last Thursday that he was acting on primitive emotion. He had diminished capacity to act rationally. And his defense attorney, Colleen Duarte, said that he suffered from PTSD from sexual abuse as a child. He also experienced 2 concussions and a dependence order that made him kind of center on his wife, fixated on his wife.
A sad story there. We heard a lot. We spoke about it last week on the Roundup as well. Let's move on. A town administrator has resigned now in Brewster. And last week on this program, we talked about some of the questions that have been raised by an audit. What do we know about what's happened here?
Well, Brewster Town Administrator Michael Ambarisa has submitted his resignation. The chairwoman Cynthia Bingham confirmed that. And actually, he has been on vacation since June 4th. And there is a separation agreement. It needs to be signed. And this is anticipated that the Board of Selectmen will sign it at their next meeting. Mm-hmm. He's been on the boards. Michael Embury has been the town administrator since 2015. He replaced Charles Sumner, who was a longtime town administrator, 29 years. And basically, but Embury and the Board of Selectmen have been knocking heads recently over several issues. And one of them was that annual audit that called the accounting procedures into question. It especially was the question of reconciling the way that expenditures and revenues were reconciled to the general ledger. So the Board of Selectmen are considering an independent audit.
And what happens now for Brewster? They need to move forward here.
They'll be moving forward, but first they have to actually sign the separation contract with Michael Embry, who came from North Kingston, Rhode Island, where he got rave reviews. He was praised for improving the town's bond rating and shepherding it through sewer projects.
We are going to speak right now to Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, the entrance to Lake Tajmu has shoaled up, and that means that it's gotten too shallow for some boats to use. I guess there was an intention to dredge this to increase the depth this past off-season, but that didn't happen?
Yeah, so a lot of frustrated mariners, as you said, because of this shoaling at the entrance to Lake Tajmu, where about 290 people have boats there, and mariners came out to a meeting of the Tisbury Board of Selectmen this week to talk about this issue, because the entrance has become nearly impassable because of overdue dredging, as you pointed out. And this is, of course, made worse by storms this winter that moved a lot of sand around. And at low tide right now, the channel depth is about 3.5 feet deep, and ideally it should be closer to 7 feet. And one captain, commercial fisherman, Tubby Madero, said, you know, he's been forced out of Tajmu because he drops 4.5 feet and he can't get out of the lake with a full load. So there's a lot of frustration from people who rely on that lake, especially for their livelihoods. And a survey found that about 2,000 cubic yards of sand and material need to be removed from the bottom of the lake to cut a path through the channel. So permitting is required for dredging. It's pretty regulated from the Army Corps of Engineers and the State Division of Marine Fisheries. And it turns out that it sounds like right after the newest harbor master was appointed in 2016, he said he realized that nearly all the permitting that's required for dredging had expired for Tajmu. They weren't fully renewed until last November, but this left a really short window because the dredge season ends in January because of to protect sea life like winter flounder. So there's that time restraint, but then cost was also a concern. The lowest estimate to dredge the channel came in about $40,000 over what they had budgeted, so they had that funding gap. So in short, the town missed the January deadline. They applied for a waiver to do it, you know, past the allowed season. That was denied. And so now they're kind of faced with this, you know, the beginning of summer, the really busy time, obviously, for people who use their boats. And they're looking at other measures. There's a brief window right now to dredge before the next kind of constriction, which is the horseshoe crab spawning season at the end of this month. And they're looking at options like maybe borrowing the Edgartown dredge. The town of Edgartown has a dredge. They could talked about borrowing it to clear the entrance, but logistics are tough for that, too. The Edgartown dredge isn't even in the water right now, so they'd have to get it in the water, so that would be costly. There's also now a piping plover nest near the channel that could complicate things. I think they're looking at options, but it seems like it might be a tough thing to get accomplished with all the constraints. And meanwhile, there are, as I said, a lot of frustrated sailors and fishermen who came out this week, you know, to question why the permits weren't renewed sooner. You know, one person pointed out that the town really has a tradition of maritime history, so it's kind of embarrassing that this happened. But in the meantime, you know, the harbor master has pointed out that most mariners are still able to get through the channel. A boat did run aground last weekend, but I guess most can exit and enter without difficulty, especially at high tide.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you. Bye.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll hear from Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Hi, Steve.
Tim, Harwich has a popular swap shop out at its disposal facility. Maybe too popular, it turns out. Tell us what the story is here.
Yeah, it's kind of like a case of too much of a good thing here. The treasure chest, as you said, is Harwich is a swap shop where people can drop off and pick up used items, clothing, books, furniture that other people can take away and use. It basically, it serves a valuable purpose because it keeps items out of the waste stream, which ultimately cuts down on the town's waste disposal costs. But the swap shop in Harwich has become so popular that the volunteers who run it have become overwhelmed. Now, the swap shop in Harwich is unique in that it's always been open to residents of any Cape town, not just Harwich residents. Other swap shops, like the one in Chatham here, is only available to Chatham residents. And the one in Chatham, like the one in Brewster, are only open seasonally. And recently, Dennis closed its swap shop because of a reported mismanagement or something to that effect. That's meant that a lot more people have been coming to the Harwich treasure chest. And so basically, the volunteers who run that facility can't handle the volume of material coming in at this point. And also, because there's so much coming in, they've also increased the amount of material that's been brought that can't be reused. You know, people might drop off something that looks good, but it doesn't work or something to that effect. Has to go to the transfer station and be sent off with the rest of the town's solid waste. So that's increasing cost to the town. So the Board of Selectmen here, acting on a recommendation by the Director of Public Works and the committee that runs the treasure chest, voted to restrict access to Harwich residents only. Beginning July 1st, a special treasure chest sticker will be required to get in. And right now that's available for free for Harwich residents. They can get them at the community center or town hall. Next year, DPW Director Lincoln Hooper said he anticipates there being a nominal fee for this to cover basically sticker costs and administrative costs. And this limitation should cut down on the volume of items coming in, make it more manageable. The head of the Treasure Chest Committee, Tom Caruso, said he expects it to cut the volume down by 40% to 50%. So that kind of shows you how much was coming from out of town. And he said they'll be able to handle that flow of material. So it looks like the restriction will help resolve the situation, although it's not going to be welcomed by residents from other towns, a number of whom have already submitted complaints to the Harwich Board of Selectmen.
Asking that they not be denied to bring stuff to the swap shop.
Correct. Asking that the town make an exception for residents of maybe nearby towns, you know, adjacent towns, that kind of thing. Because, for instance, in Dennis, they don't have a swap shop anymore, so they don't have any place to bring those kind of things or to pick them up. You know, a lot of people who are in certain income qualifications or categories or whatever depend on swap shops to get certain items, and not being able to go to the Harwich one, some people have said could be a hardship. So far, selectmen haven't responded to that. They've stuck with the restriction, and at this point, it doesn't look like they're going to readdress the situation.
Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
With me is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, recreational marijuana appears to be slow coming to the Cape and Islands. Your reporter, Chris Legere, takes a look at some of the issues that are slowing that process. One of them, I gather, is the host agreement that's required between a business and the town.
Yeah, well, the way Christine put it is that if you want to buy recreational marijuana, then your future, as easily as you buy a six-pack of beer, you're going to have to cross the canal to do it. Because, yes, the state requires a host agreement. They require applicants to sign a host agreement with the town in which they will operate this recreational marijuana facility, whether it's growing or selling, processing. Well, no one has been able to put together this package in Barnstable, Dukes, or Nantucket counties. Now, there are 14 counties in the state, and all the 11 other counties, applicants have completed packages. And some entrepreneurs are accusing towns on the Cape of dragging their feet.
This has to do with the fact that recreational marijuana is going to become legal statewide July 1st, but none of the towns on the state will at that date have anything in place here.
Right. And what's happening on the Cape also is that there are plans in motion, but none of these host agreements have been signed, so there are actually no completed applications before the Cannabis Control Commission at the state level. David DeWitt has formed the High Dune Craft Cooperative with Outer Cape Farmers. And he said they said this is going to be a high-end product, but he said that the lack of these host agreements is and this delay will prevent them from getting in on the ground floor of this business opportunity.
And what do the towns have to say in their defense?
Well, he says, for one thing, DeWitt is accusing Wellfleet and Truro of taking too long. Truro town manager Rand Palmer said that she has the proposed host agreement from the craft cooperative. It's now in the hands of the town attorney, and officials are drafting zoning regulations for the recreational marijuana. She said those zoning regulations are likely to go to special town meeting in September. She also said there is some concern on the local level, some confusion among people about whether this is, you know, how will be a legitimate enterprise, will bring in any criminal elements. So that's all going to be pretty actively discussed, I would presume, on the floor of town meeting.
And I know in Provincetown, one of the considerations is whether recreational marijuana sales should be how they should be apportioned through seasonal businesses or year-round businesses.
Yeah, that's a big discussion. And some towns actually have banned, several towns on the Cape have banned the whole process of growing, selling, or processing recreational marijuana. Chatham, Dennis, Falmouth, Harwich, Sandwich, and Yarmouth have banned. Now, temporary moratoriums are in place in Bourne, Orleans, Mashpee, and Nantucket.
This is a startup industry. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward here. After an unprecedented number of trips this year canceled due to mechanical breakdowns, the Steamship Authority is seeking an outside independent review of its operations. The request has gone out, and they've gotten some responses. Tell us about this.
Yeah, 8 consulting firms, some as far away as Germany and as close as Boston, has submitted proposals to conduct what is being called an independent comprehensive review of the Woods Hole, Martha's Vineyard, and Nantucket Steamship Authority operations. They submitted this by a Tuesday deadline. The Steamship Authority put out requests for proposal after this hearing last month, and there were dozens of Martha's Vineyard residents at the hearing. They were complaining about the patchy service this winter and spring.
Where did they get requests? Where did they get responses to the RFP from?
Well, as I mentioned, Germany, Boston, Atlanta, New Orleans. So it's from all over, basically. And what these requests for proposals are seeking suggestions to improve the vessel operations, fleet maintenance, communication. And that was another thing. People were complaining about communication mm-hmm. between the Steamship Authority and people who are stranded in hotels. Like, what do we do? When can we go? You know, how long are we going to be here? How long are we going to be stuck here? And people, you know, they had doctor's appointments that they missed and family events. It was just there was a lot of unhappiness with the Steamship Authority this winter.
Well, the Steamship Authority has hired a new communications director, understand.
Yes, as a matter of fact. Yeah, it is Sean Driscoll from the Cape Cod Times. And today is actually his last day. And they've hired him. This is a brand new communications director position. So they're hoping, and I'm sure he'll do a great job. And this will, you know, with communicating with the customers and with the public. The Steamship Authority also has this test pilot project where customers can buy tickets at the Thomas B. Landers parking lot. And the idea is that they'll avoid these long lines at the temporary terminal in Woods Hole.
A little bit of concern on the Steamship Authority board about the process by which they're going to review these independent review. They have all these applicants. They have to figure out which one they're going to go with.
Well, they will be reviewing it within the next couple of weeks. And they said that they could award the contract as soon as their next meeting on June 19th. So they have their work cut out for them in the meantime.
We're going to speak now with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Ed.
Good morning, Steve.
Ed, there's a new type of vehicle. I want to be careful here not to call it a bicycle that's causing a fair amount of consternation in Provincetown. Explain for us what this is about.
You're exactly right, Steve. This vehicle is called the Urbe, spelled URB-E, and it is described as a foldable electric vehicle. It looks like a sort of odd little bicycle with two small wheels, and it's electric powered. It does not have pedals, and the issue is whether this thing is a bicycle or a scooter. And the reason why this is important is because of the parking problems in Provincetown. Parking here is a major issue in the season. There's very limited on-street parking. We have tens of thousands of visitors. Many of them arrive in cars. There was quite a scene outside Town Hall on Tuesday this week because on Monday night, the selectmen at their meeting decided that these Urbes were not electric bicycles but scooters and therefore had to abide by the regulations for motorized 2- and 3-wheeled vehicles like scooters and mopeds, which are, among other things, banned from parking at bike racks. And so the new rules for these Urbes say that they have to park in regular car parking spots. Well, on Tuesday, trying to follow the regulations, the owners of a company called Coast Provincetown, who bought, I think, 20 or so of these Urbes and are renting them to visitors, had their two Urbes parked in car parking spots outside Town Hall, to the hilarity and consternation of various people who wanted to park their cars. The selectmen apparently didn't really think through the entire situation regarding parking. Select board member Lees King, who was just elected this year, said in the 2-hour discussion on Monday night on this subject, she said that she was most concerned about the speed of this scooter going down Commercial Street. Now, that it has a top speed of, I believe, 18 miles an hour. It's quite silent. And she said there's a distinction between a pedal assist electric motor on a pedal bicycle and this Irby machine. She said, in her opinion, it fits more in line with a scooter, a moped-style, fast-moving, throttle-controlled vehicle, rather than an electric bicycle, which has regular pedals, but a pedal-assist motor attached. And that was King's rationale for deciding that it should be considered a scooter. But so the upshot of this, the selectman's decision is that these Irbys, first of all, will not be able to be ridden down Commercial Street against the traffic, Commercial Street being one way, of mm-hmm. course, as regular bicycles are allowed to do, and will not be allowed to park at bike racks. When one of the owners of Coast Provincetown, Heather Baker, who works at the AIDS support group and who normally has been riding her Irby to work and folding it up and leaving it at a bike rack, on Tuesday she instead, trying to follow the law, parked it in a car parking spot. And when she came back, it had been moved and sort of propped up against a sidewalk bench by a Provincetown police officer who was reacting to complaints by motorists. The police chief, Jim Golden, later said that he had not had time by Tuesday, the day after the selectman's meeting, to brief all of his officers on the selectman's decision. So after that, apparently the Irbys will be allowed to stay, although there are issues related to that, because Irbys have no license plate. And so if they're parked overtime, it's impossible for the parking enforcement people to give them tickets. So this is a mess that's going to have to still be worked out somehow. In the meantime, the owners of Coast Provincetown say they're going to file a lawsuit. They say it's harassment and discrimination.
Ed Miller from the Provincetown Banner. Ed, thanks for catching us up to speed on that.
A pleasure, Steve.
With me is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. I'm Steve Junker. Cindy, a new report out has found the Cape's skin cancer rate is among the nation's worst. You did the reporting here. Tell us what's happening and tell us what people can do about it.
Yeah, well, apparently Cape Codders are paying for their years of unprotected fun in the sun. According to the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association's Health of America report, the Cape Cod region ties with the Melbourne area of Florida for the nation's third highest rate of skin cancer. And he said it's really high. It's 8.6% among residents with commercial insurance. That's how they categorized it. And this is the highest census tracts are around the Sarasota area with 10%, but the Cape is really, really close.
On the state level, we also have some of the deadliest form of skin cancer, apparently.
Yeah, if you look at the state profile that's online, it's the National Cancer Institute and the CDC. The Cape and Islands have the highest rates of melanoma in Massachusetts. So, and part of that is the age of the population here. We're an older population. And it takes Dr. Bruce Nash of Blue Cross Blue Shield was saying, most skin cancers take years to develop. Melanoma rates are usually higher in older men than older women. And except when you get to the tanning booth phenomenon, that young women can get deadly melanomas within a much shorter period of time. So some of the advice is, you first of all avoid tanning booths, but apply enough sunscreen when you go outside. That use at least a shot glass of sunscreen and apply it every 2 hours. You're not one and done. You keep applying that sunscreen and apply it again after you go in the water and dry off. Apply half an hour before you go out in the sun to give it time to absorb. And don't just count on some loosely woven clothing to protect you. That summer clothing, what they say, the doctors say, will not provide much help.
The thinking on this has evolved so much from when some of us were younger and we used to go out and get a sunburn by July 4th and figure you were kind of set for the summer.
Well, yeah, Dr. Nash talked to me about his sister putting foil around the record albums and using them as reflectors out there in the sun, and then the baby oil and the mercurochrome. And I talked to Dr. Peter Hopewood, who's a surgeon here in Falmouth, and he said that, he got up blistering, you know, sunburn every summer. And that was kind of like the kickoff, the 4th of July weekend. That was the whole the kickoff. Yeah, summer's here. Might not enjoy the feeling, but, you know, you saw that as like a rite of passage to enjoy your summer. And he's saying that there is an exploding number of melanomas on the Cape, and dermatologists here are treating more than 100 cases a year. Mm. He sees the one that requires surgery. He's saying that, you know, luckily what he's seeing are very early stages, so he can excise them. It might pop up later, you know what I mean? But you have to get treated as early as possible because it is a particularly deadly form of skin cancer.
This is the News Roundup. With me is Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. We're going to go to the break now. When we come back, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. There's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
George, you've got a strong story about a local family that's gotten caught up in an immigration problem. Explain what's happening here.
Yeah, this is Liza Simino, and she is in Brazil right now with her family and unable to get out of the country and back into the United States. Rich Salzberg did this story back in 2004. Liza came to the United States as a 17-year-old. She entered without a visa with a Mexican guide. And initially she traveled to Braintree, but eventually wound up here on the Vineyard. And through the years, she's worked here and lived here and got married here, has a 7-year-old and a 2-year-old. And they're really worried. She wanted to get this immigration, her immigration status settled. And in order to do that, she had to go back to Brazil to the consulate there. And in the process, there has been some sort of a misunderstanding. There's a belief that she was arrested back in 2004, which isn't the case. But that's holding up her her status and getting this all straightened out. You know, it's a really difficult situation. You know, her friends here on the island are trying to get you know, anybody they can to notice this. We understand that both Senator Warren's office and Senator Markey's office are involved, trying to help out in any way they can. They're not able to comment too much on this because they say that there are certain privacy issues involved in dealing with constituents. And we did hear, since this story has been published, that also Congressman Keating is involved, seeing what he can do. He obviously represents the Cape and Islands in Congress. So, you know, a very difficult situation. And, you know, the current administration's hard line on immigration seems to be at play here, and we're hearing a lot about that in other places, as you know. So it'll be interesting to follow this and see what happens. But right now, the family is really looking at the possibility that they might have to leave without her, without this being settled.
Mm. You've got another story I want to touch on quickly, a different kind of story. It's about some high school students on the island who have set up a molecular lab in the classroom, I believe, and they're studying ticks and testing them. Tell us about this.
Yeah, I got to tell you, this may be my favorite story of the week because it involves some high school students really going above and beyond. These are three seniors, Maggie Burke. Oh, I'm sorry, and two of them are juniors, Sam Cranston and Owen Engler. They're top-level science students at the high school here. And they went to their teacher and said, we want to do something a little different. And she set up this independent study for them, and they created a tick lab. As listeners, I'm sure, know, Martha's Vineyard is a hotbed for ticks and Lyme disease. And so they've set up this lab to test ticks to see if they carry Lyme. And it's really an exciting project. They're going to be talking about it at the Vineyard Haven Library on Tuesday night. And I know you don't have a lot of time to talk about this, so we'll let people go to our website and read it.
George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Steve. Have a good weekend.
You too. This is the News Roundup. On the Point, I'm Steve Junker with Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, some employers have been hit by a new state fee that goes along with having employees getting health insurance through state-subsidized programs. A local state lawmaker now has introduced a bill that would exempt some businesses from this. It's a little bit complicated to explain, but it can make a big difference to some businesses.
Oh, yeah. This is something that Governor Charlie Baker really wanted, and he got it. This is called this supplemental state fee, and it's assessed to employers when they if they have workers who are receiving health insurance from MassHealth or the Massachusetts Health Connector. Now, it went into effect January 1st, and the per-employee cost is up to $750 a year, and it's made a huge impact on some local businesses, including nonprofit organizations like Capabilities in Hyannis, which serves people with disabilities. In April, they got what they call an unbudgeted expense bill for $26,000 for the first quarter assessment from this fee. And they said they're already paying $1.3 million annually for employee health coverage. But when people earn below a certain income level, they can qualify for MassHealth. And then the state allows them to go on the MassHealth program. But Baker is saying, no, you've got to do something. If you're not giving the employer these employees this health coverage, you're going to have to help us pay for MassHealth, because I think last year it was something like 40% of the state budget. But these businesses are saying it's onerous, especially, you know, the small businesses and the seasonal businesses and nonprofit organizations. So this is where State Senator Julian Sear has stepped in. He has an amendment that's already passed the Senate that would require the state to establish a hardship waiver for these types of businesses.
So small businesses and nonprofits are really at
right.
the heart of this.
And seasonal businesses,
and seasonal
correct.
Businesses.
Yeah.
Let me talk to you about the Yarmouth Police canines. They have a new piece of equipment that may keep them and other police officers safer. Your intern, Colleen Cronin, did a nice job reporting this.
Yeah, this is something called, it's kind of very interesting. It's a canine camera and will allow police officers' canine partners to have what they're calling eyes on the ground. This is a camera that will allow them to go into situations and just, you know, and send images back of what the dog is seeing, what the dog on the four legs is seeing. And it can go, the images can go through concrete, go, you know, up to 1,000 feet, and also in total darkness. So, and this, of course, is after the tragic shooting death of Officer Sean Gannon. In April, when he went into a situation, he's a Yarmouth officer, but he was trying to serve a warrant in Marston's Mills, and he and his dog were both shot. His dog survived, but his dog Nero was alone in the attic for hours, and police, you know, didn't know what was happening with the man who's accused of shooting.
And this is not an inexpensive piece of equipment.
It was $30,000, and it's paid for by donations from the Yarmouth Police Foundation.
And that is a group of people who feel like it's important to support the police in these initiatives.
Right. And actually, and then there's a Barnstable Police K-9 Foundation that's raising money to get similar equipment for their department. And it wouldn't be used in all situations. This would be something where maybe a SWAT team would be called in, or, you know, there'd be like some kind of building search where, again, you could send the dog ahead and then you wouldn't endanger the officer. And hopefully you'd be creating more of a safety zone for the dog, too.
We're going to speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com, the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hey, Steve.
Andy, New Bedford has a number of older and historic churches that have closed recently. You've put together a nice look at these. And the question is really, what happens to these buildings?
Well, yes, and it's a difficult question. We did look at a number of churches. These are magnificent church buildings in the city. Some of them closed, others that may be closing in the future or that are just having trouble keeping up with the expenses. So many of these churches are really, they're architectural marvels. They're built like castles at the turn of the century. And over the years, especially in recent years, congregations dwindled, you know, from thousands of members down to just a scattering. And even when parishes merged, they merged at times to control costs and try to consolidate, the churches were still too big and expensive. You know, so there's these giant stone or brick buildings with stained glass windows, steeples. You know, they've got bell towers. One is a beautiful pipe organ. And city historians and preservation groups are struggling to find ways to save them. But it looks like, you know, they all can't be saved. We took a look at one of the churches, the Trinity Methodist Church. It's this towering red brick building on County Street, and it closed about 6 years ago. So like others, the congregation moved out because they couldn't afford the upkeep and utilities, and it was purchased by a developer, and he's got a vision for what he calls a South Coast marketplace. The developer is and lawyer is Robert Exafaris, and he wants to have a dinner club with a dance floor, performing musicians, a space for artists, a cafe. You know, there's just so much that he wants to do, and even, including a convention center, which is something the city hasn't had since the 1950s. But that's a really wide road to hoe, and with other churches that have fallen into disrepair, you know, it's going to take probably more than $1 million to get the building in shape and up to code. One benefit for the Trinity Methodist Church is the property was rezoned for mixed use so that he could, you know, he could do that. There's a church that's open. It's a beautiful that was open. Actually, it closed about the same time as St. John the Baptist. That was in 2012. It was closed. It was the oldest Portuguese Catholic church in the country. And you know, there was protests when it closed from the Portuguese American parishioners. There was talk of make it into this Portuguese cultural center, but you know, there still hasn't been a reliable buyer for this. And it's a beautiful building, and there are more. There are six New Bedford churches that have already closed. You know, a number of them are Catholic churches, Saint Anne, Saint John the Baptist in the South End, Saint Killian's, Saint Casimir's, St. Teresa's, and you know, it's largely the cost. One of the churches that's still open has high ceilings, and we were told that the heating bills in the winter could top $2,000 a week, and you know, that's just to keep the temperature at a tolerable, you know, in the 50s, and so you're expected to wear a coat inside. But there is one church, and I have to talk about this. It's because it's it's a great success story, and it's ongoing. The First Baptist Church, it was built in 1829, and it's under renovation as a theater, and it's being managed. The work is in a cooperation with the city, the Waterfront Historic Area League, and the Interchurch Council of New Bedford. And there's an arrangement that keeps the congregation at the church. And this is a very historic building. It was the center for abolitionist activity, and it's the site where Robert's Rules of Orders were first used during the Civil War. So there's a lot, and there's some great photos, and we have it online, and you can find it at southcoasttoday.com.
Andy Tomalonis of southcoasttoday.com. Andy, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times with me. Cindy, Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital unveiled a new piece of equipment that folks can use to get off the trail. It was part of an annual event held last weekend.
Yeah, last weekend was the 10th anniversary of the Sport and Spirit Weekend for Disabled Military Veterans. And during this last Friday, they unveiled this all-terrain motorized wheelchair called a track chair. And it's pretty cool. It has these long treads, like little bulldozer or something, and it can take you into the woods. And people can go for hikes that they couldn't go on before. They can go down to swimming holes. They can go fishing. They can go hunting. They can really get deeply into the woods in a way that they couldn't before because of their disabilities.
And this, the money for this was raised by a group?
Yeah, it's the Korean War Veterans of Delaware, and this is a $17,500 gift from them. And they had some veterans on the scene and presenting the chair, and they said they've had some kind of connection with Spalding in the past, so they worked with them on this. And after the weekend, it is going to this McGraw Center for Adaptive Sports at Nickerson State Park in Brewster for the public to use. And this center opened last summer in collaboration with Spalding Rehabilitation Network and the State Department of Conservation and Recreation. And it is the first recreational program for people with disabilities that has a permanent home in a state park. So it's something pretty unique. And when they unveiled it last summer, it was interesting to see all the equipment that they had. And it included recumbent bikes, swimming chairs, and even special tools that will help people get out there and kayak.
Cindy, the manager of the Barnstable Airport is retiring. He's seen it through some big changes. Bud Brial is his name. And Jeff Spillane, your reporter at the Cape Cod Times, has a nice profile of him.
Yeah, Roland Bud Brialt has been there for 9 years, and he's 75 years old. He actually has half a century of public service. And while he was at the airport, he oversaw construction of a new terminal, tower, and roadways. So he oversaw some major projects. And before that, he was actually in the Coast Guard. He ended that career as the commander of the Groupwoods Hole. He was a Truro Town Administrator for 8 years. And then he was a project manager for construction at the Hyannis Youth and Community Center that opened in 2009.
I thought some of the interesting points in this article have to do with the airport is beautiful, but it's actually being underused at this moment.
Yeah, Brialt said that fiscal 2018 and 2019 were the only 2 years in the airport's history that it had to borrow money, had to borrow money from reserves to balance the budget. One of the big issues is that there's now these fast ferries that are getting people to locations, and he said that they're bypassing the airport to use the fast ferries instead of the airport. So what he would like to see is, he would like the next person to kind of reinvent the airport and to already had. In 2014, the JetBlue summer service between Hyannis and New York City started, and Brialt's hoping that other major carriers will come in, and not just for the summer, that there'll be daily, year-round service to a hub city. He said that could really make a difference with the airport.
And the airport is also available, I didn't know this until I read the article, as an event space that people can rent out. And they've had some events there recently, which is...
Well, you think that would be kind of a fun space. Your theme would be built right in for you.
And it's beautiful. The new airport really is a nice building. I want to talk about a well-known TV chef and food personality, Anthony Bourdain, who passed away last week. He had a local connection. He started his culinary career in Provincetown, and Gwen Friss has a remembrance from folks there.
Yes, Gwen wrote that he started out sort of by his culinary life almost by accident 43 years ago. He was actually staying with a friend at the crashing of the home of Nancy Poole, and he was just kind of like lounging about and deciding what to do next in his life, broke, unemployed, thinking of being a writer. And she said, very Provincetown. She was like, hey, we're tired of seeing you lazy around. We need a dishwasher at the flagship restaurant. You're it. You're coming in to work with me the next day. So he started out there as a dishwasher. Like the energy of the food environment, and this story was told from John Yingling, who's the owner of Bubble Is by the Bay and Spiritus Pizza. He said Bourdain told him that story, and Poole later confirmed it. So it's a true story.
And then Bourdain, this week, obviously he died, and it turns out that it was a suicide.
Right. And, yes. The second celebrity suicide just in days after Kate Spade in New York.
Tell us just a little bit more about Bourdain's career there then.
Okay. Well, he was the author of Kitchen Confidential, and for many years he would not name the Provincetown restaurants where many of his wildest adventures took place, but that book appealed to people way beyond the restaurant industry. It just struck a chord with the public. Then he hosted shows on the Food Network and the Travel Channel, and then was on CNN's Parts Unknown, and that's what he was working on when he was found dead in his hotel room in France. And he was really, not just a great chef, but a food ambassador. He connected people and cultures through food, and just a very beloved person. And he also, and people have very kind words to say about him in Provincetown. And he visited the Lobster Pot in 2014 with a crew of 30 and was a personable and approachable person.
You have an article out today in the Cape Cod Times looking at suicide prevention efforts across the Cape, particularly with supporting young people.
Yes. Well, there's a Cape organization that is working to prevent suicides, and it's called Sharing Kindness. And it was founded by Dr. Kimberly Mead Walters and her husband, Davis Walters, after their 16-year-old son, Jeremy, took his life in 2016. And she said this is a public health crisis. So what they've done this past year, the members from this group this past year, have arranged for 500 staff people from throughout the Nauset Regional School District to receive online training on suicide prevention. They've also had people from the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention meet with 10th and 12th graders and to watch DVDs and then also break apart and have discussions in small groups. The next plan that they want to do, and they hope this will be in place by the fall, is to get a grief counselor to help young people who are suicide survivors. That means young people who've lost friends and family to suicide, or maybe have survived an attempt themselves, because they said this is a big need here on the Cape, where suicide rates are slightly higher than the rest of Massachusetts.
That is our news roundup for the week. I want to thank my guest, Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thanks for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
And thanks to our other contributors. We spoke with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. We spoke with Ed Miller at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and heard from Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. I'm Steve Junker. Thank you for listening.